And our next speaker is David Segrist.
Yes, I will set you up, David.
He's going to set us up. Is that fantastic or what? Okay, David Segrist, speaking on humans, accident, or inevitable. Dr. Segrist received his PhD in biodefense from George Mason University. There, his research interests centered on statistical anomaly detection in numbers of patients presenting for medical care in order to provide early warning of outbreaks of disease. He works for the MITRE Corporation, which takes no position on any of the issues Dr. Segrist might raise today and is not responsible for them. Having spent my career at a secular institution, I understand that byline. Dr. Segrist also teaches classes on science and religion at National Presbyterian Church in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you for coming. Is this working? Hold it closer. Okay, good. Thank you for coming, and thank you for staying. You're a hearty lot here at the ASA. I'd also like to thank the ASA for letting me speak. This is a theology panel, and I'm kind of, and my presentation is a little bit science heavy, and so I'd like to know about how many people in the room consider themselves more theological, and how many consider themselves more scientists. So theologians, okay, scientists, okay, all right, I guess we're going to be okay. For the theological people, and I've been told I have dense presentations, I don't understand that at all, but there's a couple of different levels to look at my stuff if you want to. You don't have to follow closely all of the detail. It's there basically to show my work and to show that there's some substance under the claims I'm about to make, right? So, and I'd suggest that if you're just kind of coasting on it, you look for signs. A theme would be serendipity. I'm going to be talking about things that seem to be naturally ordained and seem to be baked in or naturalistic tendencies that tend to support the creation of life and more developed life. But I'm also going to talk about a series of accidents that presumably could have gone either way, extreme unlikelihoods that happened once in like 4 billion years. Okay, so that's unlikelihood. But I think the theme that brings them together is serendipity, and or what some folks here might call providence. Okay. And I'll just foot stomp on what Lynn said, that the MITRE Corporation takes no position on what I'm about to say here, but don't get excited. I don't think it's too controversial, I hope, or I think. But I'm on my own, and this is my hobby, right? So that's what I do. Let's see. So accident. Physicists, and we've started to touch on this in the other talks, it's a finely tuned universe that seems to be especially set up somehow. One gentleman said, someone had monkeyed with the laws of physics and that now blind chance has very little to do with what happened. Very good. The fellow that discovered the carbon resonance?
Fred Hoyle,
thank you. Okay. Seems to be fine-tuned, but then the question that arises is, if it's so fine-tuned, then why don't we hear more, see more evidence of life coming around from the rest of the universe? Seems to be a fair question. Billions and billions. If there is a natural tendency, we should see more of it. We're not seeing it. Okay. My initial answer to that would be, we had a gentleman here yesterday, the author of Rare Earth, right? So I'm going to talk about that theme here. Life appears to need special handling, and Earth is a very special place that supports the development of life. It has dynamic stability in that water, the matrix of life, can remain within approximately 100 degrees centigrade for 4 billion years, and yet have enough thermodynamic disequilibrium that it supports the exchange of energy and thus complexification and evolution given enough time, right? Okay, so some of the specific things are the protective magnetosphere, which protects us from the solar wind, thin crust that enables plate tectonics so that the heavier elements have come into the crust of the Earth and then they get circulated up and weathered into the whole ecosystem and become available for use by living organisms. Okay. And abnormally, of course, that gives you your tsunamis and your volcanoes. So we were talking about natural harm before. At least there's something coming out of it. An abnormally large moon, which stabilizes the axis of the axial tilt and tidal flows of the oceans. So all good things. Planet is able to maintain surface temperatures, supports long-term change while having a framework of general stability. Okay. So if we think about the elements, right, the most basic elements and some of the most prolix elements are the ones that are needed for life, right? So that if we consider here on the upper left and the upper right, the ones that are circled are the ones that are bulk elements that are needed for life and are used in life. The ones with the little squares are more rare, okay? So we would see that if you're saying he made certain elements and the, if we're looking for evidence of design, the fact that what they made most of first is the stuff that's needed for life might be interesting. Okay, so also the energy for life comes from what are called redox reactions, oxidation reduction chemical reactions, in which an electron moves from what would be on the upper left here, the yellow boxes, to the blue boxes, elements of those. And that's the way that nature has chosen to provide energy to support chemical reactions in the cell. It's not a lot of energy, but it is enough and well matched. For those who are a little shy on their history of redox reactions, I'll just illustrate it here. Whereas you remember that it has to be a certain number of electrons in the outer shell to make it happy. And that if you have an extra one, it then moves over to the one that needs one, and then this brings the elements together. What I'm saying is in a redox reaction, we find that the electrons that are moved have a way of depositing energy as they move through the cell. And the cell uses that to do things like bind amino acids together or whatnot. It's the contention that this process started chemically and then was taken up by photosynthesis when photons were used to dislodge electrons and move them along, right? So this is going to be a continuing theme in how does life get its energy? Okay, so there, catalysis. A catalyst is something that stimulates a reaction but is not consumed in the reaction. So what we find is that there are certain autocatalytic cycles, which in this case, it's a famous one, the Krebs cycle or the citric acid cycle. 9 reactions, and each one produces a catalyst for the next reaction so that it becomes a self-sustaining or autocatalytic cycle. Autocatalytic cycle, right? So it can run in two ways, but when it runs in the way that's creating these byproducts, in addition to the catalyst, it's also making, if we start in the upper left corner and we move around from the 11 o'clock position clockwise, amino acids, purines, pyrimidines. Okay, so you know amino acids, they make up proteins. The purines, pyrimidines, making up nucleic acids, right? Building blocks for them. Glucose, always need some. fatty acids and sterols. Fatty acids can make up the membranes that form the compartments that later become the cell, right? Need those. Purines, amino acids. Perforins, I think of perforins as the frames that hold the catalysts that make, that, for instance, allow you to have oxygen circulation in your blood. So, Okay. So with the theme of serendipity, I'm just pointing out the fact that there just happens to be elements that are useful, a reaction where, for a reason that I can't explain, relates to quantum mechanics from the last talk, of why they want to have that number of electrons in the shell, but transporting them over, and then once you get here, you're having an autocatalytic cycle that just happens to make the things we need to live. It could have just happened. You know, it might be just one of those things. Could be. Okay, so if we go back further, we were talking about prebiotic chemistry in the last talk. We mentioned it. Okay, so just want to draw your attention to the fact that there was an article that came out a couple years ago, but anyway, Sutherland. And so he's talking about the cyanosulfitic protometabolism. There you go. Okay, so that he has, and his team, at I believe, is it Oxford or Cambridge, have come up with a way that with cyanide and hydrogen sulfide, you can create precursors for the vital chemicals that I started to talk about here. And you can do it basically more or less in a warm little pond within the presence of copper and some energy source, which, oh, by the way, since there was no ozone layer at the time, there might have been coming from overhead. Okay, so he was commissioned, I guess, to do an article about this for Nature Chemistry, and he said something Churchillian, that we're not at the end, we're not at the beginning of the end, but we at least may be at the end of the beginning of trying to figure out prebiotic chemistry. Okay, so one of the problems in prebiotic chemistry is that you need a number of things at the same time for it to succeed. Evolution needs information, so RNA needs to be first. You need building blocks and energy for life, so metabolism must be first. Genetics and metabolism need catalysts, so proteins must be first. Finally, selection needs compartments, so lipids need to be first. Okay. So that what this does, and what I think Sutherland and his team's tremendous contribution, is to find a way that they're starting to make the different elements all at the same time. So if we say, why is life tough to make? It's like, well, it's a hard problem. Just on compartments and serendipity, I guess, talking about hydrophobic and heads and hydrophilic tail, hydrophilic heads and hydrophobic tails. Basically, these are lipids which have a head with a little tail on them, and the head likes water and the tail doesn't. So in this case, we see the heads are basically facing away from each other, if we think of it that way, and creating little protocells. Okay. So in this, you can have compartments that naturally form once you have the lipids and they're doing their thing, in which neutrally charged moieties can escape, and charged stay in and have more chance to react with each other. So it's a very difficult problem. So I'm, again, going back to the thing of like, well, if nature is fine-tuned for life, why isn't there more of it? And I'm trying to explain why it's a real hard problem and how we're starting to track down how it might have happened naturally. And indeed, just a little backup, we find that basically from hydrogen, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, water, you can get the precursors for lipids, proteins, polysaccharides, more proteins, bases, and nucleotides. Okay, so that at least with the starting conditions here of hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon dioxide, you're making life from air. Okay? Came out of the air, ultimately. And then adding a lot of, you know, nitrogen, iron, sulfur, and the other elements that we talked about. So if you're looking for evidence of, you know, design intent or something, it looks like it's unfolding in a way And if one has a more romantic bent, one could think you could turn it over and see IKEA written on the bottom. Okay. That could be overclaiming a little bit. Okay. I'll go for it. I'll go for cute. Okay, so accident. Life emerged rather quickly once. Life emerged within a couple hundred million years of the Earth being cool enough. Earth started out very hot, and it became a solid. The seas had to condense. Okay, and when they talk about the late heavy bombardment, weather in the late heavy bombardment, when you had vapor, it could be rock vapor, right, from the asteroids hitting. They didn't call it the Hadean era for nada, okay? Terrible. And yet, there's some zircons that can go back 4.1 giga, billion years ago and have a differential relationship of the carbon 12 to 13 that indicates, but even that early, there might have been signs of life. But anyway, rather quickly, in hundreds of millions of years, it's working out to become life. And as they say, the structures had genetic code, protein, photosynthesis, the works. Life must not be a fussy, reluctant, and unlikely thing. Rather, it will emerge whenever it has an opportunity. Right? Okay. So if we take a look at the left, the prokaryote, that's what I just talked about. That is very complex to make that prokaryote. And on the right, you see the eukaryote, which is qualitatively more complex. Okay, so I've mentioned the fact that the prokaryote took a couple hundred million years to make, took a billion years to then progress on to the eukaryote, which is surprising, we think. Okay, so it took about a billion years. And we think that an archaea was fused with a bacteria and provided energy cells in the form of mitochondria, developed the nucleus. What might have caused the delay or contributed to it was the fact that it needed oxygen as an electron acceptor to enable the heavier demand for electricity, if you will, in the eukaryote. And that's still kind of a mystery as to how did that bacteria develop the way to photosynthesize. And then it was proliferated. And it could be that that was what contributed to the delay, was the fact that, darn it, we need a second kind of photosynthesis that produces oxygen. And we need to then oxidize all these greenhouse gases that are there so that there's free oxygen roaming around the atmosphere and the oceans. Okay, here's a picture of the new revised tree of life. So if we think in terms of, it must have been a rational, deliberate process going randomly that leads up to the apex, us, right? I would think that would have to be a more pyramidal structure with us at the top. And instead we see in the upper half is the bacteria, basically. The lower right are the eukaryotes, and then the archaea are, I'd say, parallel with eukaryotes over there. So I showed this picture to a friend of mine who's a mathematical physicist, and he just said, "Where are we?" I said, "Down here." He's like, "Okay." And he turns it, so we're at the top. Cool. Okay. But if you're, say, usually if we look at a graph and we're thinking in terms of random processes, we would expect, we would look for centrality. And in here we see distance. And not only that, but the line is so thin that connects them. It would seem to need to be explained. Okay. So if we're saying that humans were the point of life, I would say this picture of the tree of life tends to hold that in question, because it looks like our branch is like a rogue operation, that it kind of saw its chance to go and it took it, But it's different from what I think the naturalist would say, which is, well, life started small and then kind of moved up and now we're here. What we're seeing from genetic history and analysis is allowing a more sophisticated appreciation of how life develops. Okay. So I think it's time to turn back now more towards accidents. I'm also going to talk about a dendrogram, okay, which is an example. One is in the upper right-hand corner. So basically, it's talking about connectedness genetically, right? And so I'm going to be talking here about the Cambrian explosion, inter alia, and just say that during that time, the 19 different animal phyla got their start, right? One of the phyla was chordates. And we're a chordate, right? No chordates, no vertebrates, no us. And it just happened 525 million years ago. They developed this phyla. Okay. If it did not, then presumably we might be another, if you will, dry hole example of, well, life was starting out, it might be reaching towards what we would consider, you know, more sophisticated beings that will help the universe be more self-conscious, to be self-conscious. But it might not have happened the way it did. So I'll just go back now to Stephen Gould's talk. From the flowering of dinosaurs, the origin of human consciousness, subsequent history of animal life amounts to little more than variations on anatomical themes established during the Cambrian explosion within 5 million years. 3 billion years of unicellularity was followed by 5 million years of intense creativity and then capped by more than 500 million years of variation on set anatomical themes. So it's hard to read that as predictable, inexorable, or continuous trend. Only one member of our chordate phylum, the genus, has been found among these earliest Cambrian fossils. No vertebrates, no humans. Okay. So right now, scientists can't explain, I don't think, adequately, the Cambrian explosion. Why in 5 million years did you start to get all those things you didn't get before? And I think it has to do something with segmentation and oxygen, but that's a different story. I would claim it's not fully explained as it stands now as to why there was such an explosion at that time. But it's still having impacts today. Other accidents, lobe-finned fishes evolved fin bones, strong central axis capable of bearing weight on land, kind of moved out there because there were more food out there. Large extraterrestrial body struck the Earth 65 million years ago, wiped out the dinosaurs, left an ecological niche for those pesky mammals. A small lineage of primates evolved upright posture. All of these things are things that need not have been as they were. But then again, there's multiple fine-tunings that have to do with chemistry, which Michael Denton talks about a lot. Water is the matrix of the cell. The low viscosity helps you to get a circulatory system for a complex animal that will be able to deliver nutrients and take away waste products from complex creatures such as ourselves, whereas prokaryotes, you have to be very near the surface to be able to exchange things. And it's because of the viscosity of water and the fact that the capillaries can be that small that it can support that. Okay. Also, it has thermal properties that help you get rid of heat. That's, I think, one of the reasons we're the naked ape, because we have this very large brain that consumes about 20% of our energy, and it radiates like a light bulb, approximately. Right? How do you move that heat? Okay, nature has designed a way for it. And I would think that kind of rapid metabolism requires oxygen to draw the electrons to have enough power to do the things that we're doing now that helps the universe to be self-conscious. And some inferences I have from that. Fine-tuning of physics and chemistry have set conditions for life to emerge. I believe there is a physical chemical predisposition to life. However, the extreme complexity of life and its demanding requirements militate against the potential being fulfilled. I'd like to put forward the concept of environmental possibilism, basically where I'm getting here is the idea of an unfinished creation, and that we're products of the creation, but now we're starting to impact creation and extend it. And I'm saying that there were tendencies that support the creation of complex life, but that it creates a possibility space that needs to be explored, which leaves responsibility and agency for us as humans as part of the creation. Yep. And I think that's about what I have to say. I am wrapped up. In the back.
The subject of the talk, which you said, is human life.
Right.
Now, if you went back 4 billion years and we'd become bipedal, but we'd not discovered skeletons, we were still amongst the apes. There were still gorillas and chimpanzees which have survived today. I don't see inevitable that we became bipedal, that we then discovered stone tools, that then we then controlled fire, and so on until it became us. I don't see an inevitable. Could you argue that it would be inevitable?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't argue that it's inevitable. I was talking about all the things that are even more detrimental to the development of humans before. But absolutely, the things you mentioned would have knocked us out of the box. I briefly touched on them, but I'm saying it's possible. But those things that you mentioned need not have been as they were, and then we wouldn't be here. Absolutely.
Well, we'd be here, but we'd be quadrupeds.
Perhaps. Sir?
The great oxygen mentioned that that brought what some people would call toxicity to the existing anaerobes. In that area of 2.5 million years ago, on 1.5 million, oxygen first went to the rocks. About oxygen being almost beneficial to the bacterium, which is an interesting idea. Just what's your general view on toxicity, if at all, and thanks for being so open about what we don't know.
Thank you. Okay, oxygen, very interesting point. It's needed. What we see is that, I would say that there's a theme in evolution in which oxygen and others are such great reactants that they've already reacted. And it's only by life starting with different materials that they can create enough, for instance, free oxygen. Okay, but when they do, as you say, it's a double-edged sword. And what we find is with a number of pollutants, whatever, first they're a threat, then they become tolerated, then they become useful. So this is a process. Now, I touched briefly on the Cambrian explosion. And with oxygen in the atmosphere, but then is it in the water where we think the life was, right? So progressing down there. So I'm thinking that oxygen might have come down to the little worms or whatever we had down there at that time, and that what I find is that enhances mutation when there's a threat. When the organism is under threat, a lot of its copy correction control is loosened so that it's trying to find a way to survive, right? So then, let's say, some do, and they create space. However, oxygen comes and goes, and then they might have it and again have to mutate. So in that Cambrian time, we're seeing accelerated mutation and changes, and I think it may have to do with the interplay of what's happening with oxygen and how the phyla are starting to learn to deal with it, and it may also account for why new phyla aren't being created.
Just to tell on that, James Shapiro with epigenetics counts multiple transposable elements very well and does a good job of intelligent engineering. It seems like epigenetics would fit well there too.
I like and respect James Shapiro. I'm putting forward my thing, but things were so basic back then, I think that epigenetics wouldn't have been as valuable.
David, there's a question over here, Dan.
Yeah, that statement about the 5 million years, is that Stephen Jay Gould quote? It was in a quote.
That was from Stephen Jay Gould, yes, sir.
Well, I think that's now 200 million years. So I think we just shouldn't give the impression that it was a semi-miraculous, very short-lived process, you know, because the evidence is it probably started in the snowball Earth like 200 million years. We only see the last 5 million because that's when the like solid, the shells and stuff appear.
So, it might not be 5 million. I'd heard figures more like maybe 25 million, could be 40 million. But again, when you're comparing that to billions, I think the general point maintains.
It's just potentially misleading.
Okay, I will review that. Thank you.
Last question over here, and then we're going to.
I think epigenetics goes back way, way back. I wouldn't minimize that at all. I was talking to somebody who knew one of the authors of an early major Cambrian explosion paper, and he asked the author, so what was going on there that caused all these new body plans and everything? And he said, drought.
There was that in the thing, but I was checking out that literature, and I think it's a controversial statement.
So anyway, it wasn't in the paper, but the guy that wrote the paper said, yeah, that makes sense to me.
But yeah, I would normally expect mutational events to be associated with stressors, which could certainly include drought, and I think I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Let's thank David. And enjoy.